Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. November 10th, 2022, the extremely surprising election edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast. I'm in Denver, Colorado, gathering with my CityCast tribe. I'm so happy to be here, but it does mean that I'm not in Washington, D.C., so we have no Washington, D.C. presence because John Dickerson of CBS Primetime is in New York, fresh off what was probably like 67 straight hours of staring at a map. Hello, John.
Yeah, exactly. Well, staring mostly at tables, actually, of who voted where and how much and all that. But yes, a lot of staring into a small screen.
And then Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. She does no staring, only gazing contemplatively at the heavens. Hello, Emily from New Haven.
Hello. Good morning. I like that image of myself.
This week on the Gabfest, we will devote our first two segments to the election. What happened? Why did it happen? What was surprising? And who won? We'll talk about that in the first segment. And then in the second segment, we'll talk about the consequences of the election in terms of policy, politics, and what will change in the next 2 years and beyond. Then we'll talk about a Supreme Court case that is fascinating about the scope of the Indian Child Welfare Act and whether Indian tribes are political or racial classifications. That's a kind of simplification, but a really, really interesting case. Plus, of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, dear friends, that it is conundrum time. We are preparing for our annual conundrum show. Please send us your conundrums so we can work through life's important questions, such as, if you needed to hide an elephant, how would you do it? If you could be vice president to any president, who would it be and why? Or if you had to be a tree or a fish, which would you choose? Please submit your conundrums at slate.com/conundrums. And we are so looking forward to revisiting that this winter with you. And I'm sure we'll have a great guest to do it with, too. slate.com/conundrums.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
John, that's the question.
What I think we can say as of this taping Thursday morning, which is true, which is essentially the locked-in assumptions people had about the pain that economy and crime, let's just say, we're going to deliver to Democrats, was significantly blunted by, I think, at least two things on the Democratic side. Success on the abortion issue, using that as a motivational force in different kinds of races. In some races it worked, in some races it didn't. But abortion played a key role in protecting against the wave. So if you wear a wetsuit to protect against the wave was coming. The wetsuit is made up of voters who were motivated by the Dobbs decision. Also, though, voters, independents, and we'll get inside the numbers in a minute, particularly who were frightened, scared, whatever, about Republican extremism, independents in particular. And that, I think, touches on and connects to the idea of democracy being on the ballot. So those were two of the things that protected. And the third, and this is wrapped up with that, is that Democrats turned out in an off-year election in which traditionally, you would not expect the in party to be as motivated as Democrats appear to have been, and particularly younger voters who, black voters and younger voters in particular, voted close to their 2018 levels. And why is 2018 important? Because 2018 was kind of a record year for Democrats in those constituencies because they were motivated by Donald Trump. So here you have the in party in a midterm election where turnout is usually low, voting the way they do when they're the out party. And again, that may be because they're motivated by abortion and extremism, or they may just have turned out because they're Democrats who want, you know, the world to go in the Democratic direction.
John, actually, just situate us a little bit more. So as we are right now, it appears that the House will probably be under Republican control. Where would you rate the Senate right now?
The Senate at the moment, you've still got Arizona, as of this recording, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia. Georgia's going to a runoff. Nevada looks like it's trending red. and Arizona looks like it's turning blue. So if Republicans and Democrats split one each in Nevada and Arizona, that means control of the Senate will come down to the outcome of the runoff in Georgia, which will be decided on the 6th of December between Walker and Warnock. Runoffs are only between two candidates. And that means the entire Senate question will be up for grabs in Georgia. If for some reason Nevada doesn't go, Laxalt doesn't beat Cortez Masto in Nevada, then Georgia will lose, you know, its super powerful salience. It won't be for control of the Senate. It'll just be an important race.
Just one tiny note there, because I was surprised by this. I was looking at Joe Ralston's Twitter feed. He's a Nevada elections guru, and he made it seem more possible that Cortez Masto might pull it out based on the remaining mail-in ballots than I had assumed. So I'm just noting that for now. Very transient Thursday morning observation.
Emily, I feel like you're the living embodiment of the two issues, which seems to have broken in Democrats' favor. I mean, you've obviously written a ton about reproductive rights and how the Dobbs decision is affecting the country. And then you've also written a ton about the election denialism and election subversion. Were you surprised that these two issues seem to have resonated so much with voters?
Yes, I was surprised. And I'm going to be really curious when we get better exit polls to see if indeed this is what voters were responding to. I mean, it seemed like from the initial polls, which I think are not really weighted for who voted versus who answers exit poll questions. But it seemed like they were pretty salient and higher on voters' minds. And I was surprised. I mean, partly I think because when you cover things like this that are thorny and difficult, you kind of get a little beaten down and worry that you're not getting through to people as you're like constantly trying to make it as bright and clear and interesting as possible. So yes, I was surprised. And I think there's a dynamic where, given that the polls were off in Republicans' favor in 2016, and there's just been a sort of shaky feeling about the polls since then, and I think there just was, among a lot of pundits, this sense of that the Democrats were doomed. I think I was reading a lot of that mindset, and that made me more surprised, even though when you look at, you know, 538 or some of the other really good polling analysis, they actually like predicted a 50-50 Senate.
Yeah, I mean, they also predicted all these races that are close and that we still haven't called are all close.
Exactly.
I mean, so, you know, if Fetterman, it's not like Fetterman won by 10 points.
Exactly.
And also, it wasn't just pundits and analysts. I mean, it was the people running these campaigns. I mean, Congressman Clyburn talked to Bob Costa at the beginning of our coverage on election night. And at the beginning of the night, he was saying, you know, Democrats need to rethink their strategy and their message and all that. I mean, he was preparing for a huge wipeout.
One of the things that I've been unable to comprehend, because I am not as comprehensive in my knowledge as you are, John, is if you look across these results, is it the case that the more extreme Republican candidates did significantly worse than regular Republicans? Like, is the Republican caucus that we will see in the Senate, in the House, and in state legislatures and governor's office, is it a more traditional Republican caucus?
No.
Okay.
So, well, this is what's interesting. So look at four senators who won in Alabama, North Carolina, Missouri, and Ohio. Those four senators who are replacing Republican senators are more extreme. They are all election deniers in one form or another. Let's look at Ohio. Rob Portman wrote the infrastructure bill. J.D. Vance said he wouldn't have voted for the infrastructure bill. J.D. Vance has essentially the Trump position on trade with China. Rob Portman was a U.S. trade representative. And we can go on down the line. So in that case, you have four Republican senators coming to Washington who, at least for the purposes of winning their election, played footsie with or, in fact, gave the full embrace to Donald Trump and MAGA. Now, there are all kinds of incentives for them to pretend they didn't now because Donald Trump is in a jittery moment. And also, like Ron DeSantis won going away. However, there is, and this I'm not certain on this, but however, there was a kind of lingering issue for Republicans that kept them from winning all these races they thought they were going to win in the House race. I mean, they were incredibly overconfident about races they were going to win in places that Biden had won with 58% of the vote. Kevin McCarthy went to the 10th District of Virginia right before the election. That was a place not only that Biden had won with 58% of the vote, but Terry McAuliffe had won with 5% of the vote, and they thought they were going to possibly win in those places. And they sent the first lady down there to help shore up the Democrat in that district because Democrats were worried about that. Well, they didn't come close in the 10th. They didn't, Republicans didn't win in the 7th. They didn't win in Rhode Island 2, Connecticut 5, all these places they thought, Indiana 1, all these places they thought they were going to make inroads into, they just didn't win. And I think part of that is some of it's candidate quality. Some of it, though, is that there was a general problem for Republicans because of the extremism associated with the party. And this, even if Republicans were turning out, surprisingly for an off-year election, the in-party Democrats were turning out too.
Can I ask a question about women? There was a lot of discussion, and we talked about it too, of this idea that women seemed like they were going to vote on Dobbs over the summer, and then they seemed to be, especially independent women, swinging to Republicans. Do we know what actually happened in the end?
What we identified last week and or in our Atlanta show in the week before was that there was a big Republican swing among suburban women, and exit polls don't track suburban women that I can find at the moment. At least ours, our slicing the numbers doesn't. But what we do know is that Republicans won white women, which is sometimes a rough proxy. Republicans won them by 8 points, whereas in 2018, Democrats were even with white women. Overall, though, Democrats won women by 8 points, but that was down 11 points from the margin of victory the Democrats had in 2018. So in 2018, essentially, Democrats beat Republicans by 19 points among women. In 2022, Democrats only beat them by 8 points. So I think the trend was certainly there, women moving towards Republicans, but whether it was as large as those pre-election polls had suggested, I don't think that's the case.
I have a completely untested theory about Joe Biden's disapproval rating that I want to run by you guys. So this seems like a real yoke around the neck of Democrats that Biden's approval rating has been in the low 40s. I wonder if people care less than it seems like they should at the polls because they have a sort of mild sense of disapproval for Joe Biden. They don't love him, but they're not viscerally responding to him the way a disapproval rating for Donald Trump would translate.
That's not just a theory. It's proved by the exit polls.
Oh, how convenient for me.
Yeah, voters were much more voting against Obama and voting against Trump than they were voting against Biden, which I think is also, when we think about the determinism that was not insane for all of the strategists in the Democratic and Republican Party and lots of analysts to think about, one of the pieces of the determinism beyond the economic view was that a president, I said it 8 million times too, a president who's below 50% in approval rating has lost an average of 36 seats since World War II. And the part of that is basically, people don't like the sitting president, and the exits showed that they just weren't that exercised about Joe Biden. And so you're exactly right about that.
I cannot, just in ending, I just can't believe that this is coming down again to a Georgia Senate runoff and that we're going to have to go through this again. It is exhausting.
What's fascinating, it seems to me, about that race, we don't know if it'll be for the whole control of the Senate, which will change the dynamic, but Donald Trump is in some, there's a lot of second guessing about Trump, based on the candidates that he helped get through the primaries, and Herschel Walker is kind of the poster child for the candidate quality question. And so is Oz, obviously, and Blake Masters in Arizona. But also, Trump is in, has added to this idea of extremism, obviously, but it's not just Donald Trump. It's a party that basically, despite Trump breaking every possible rule in what was previously their set of belief systems, none of them really spoke up about it. And those that did are gone. 10 of the people who voted for Trump's second impeachment, 8 of them are gone from the House. But Trump is toxic in Georgia. I mean, David Perdue lost by 50 points to Brian Kemp in the primary for governor in Georgia. And Perdue was the hand-selected, groomed, and candidate of Donald Trump. So what happens in a runoff in terms of this break with the party, if it's happening with Trump, will they want Trump to not, spend all of his time in some other country to change that dynamic in Georgia? Or will Trump insert himself because he's worried that he's dying as everybody falls in love with Ron DeSantis?
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest every week. And this week we're going to do a Slate Plus segment on some of the closer to home, smaller, maybe slightly more obscure election results that fascinated us. We're each going to pick out one or two things that weren't main headlines in the New York Times, but which are interesting nonetheless, and talk about them. You can become a member by going to slate.com/GabFest+ today. And of course, you'll also get lots of other stuff, including no ads on any Slate podcasts and unlimited reading on the Slate site. Slate.com/GabFest+. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Now we turn to the consequences of the election. How is the country likely to be governed in the next 2 years? Who is set up for political success? Ron DeSantis. Who is set up for political success in the next 2 years and going forward? And what political and policy crises are we likely to see because of these election results? Emily, as we were finishing that last segment, talking about Trump, of course, when you talk about Trump now, you talk about DeSantis. DeSantis had this incredible, fantastically wide victory in Florida, where he really swept that state, a state which has historically been seen as a tightly contested state, but it doesn't seem to be anymore. It seems to be a Republican state. And he way outperformed, as John mentioned, his performance in his previous run for governor. And it looks like he is going to be a very serious challenger to Donald Trump.
Right. And so then you imagine if there really is a what looks like a two-person race, that Trump in particular is going to try to destroy DeSantis. I mean, we already see this with him calling DeSantis De Sanctimonious and insinuating.
Terrible nickname. De Sanctimonious?
I don't think it's that
bad. I mean, first of all, Ron DeSantis does not seem sanctimonious at all. That is not like what.
Really? I think he's kind of humorless.
I don't know. But he can be sanctimonious and it can still be a terrible nickname.
Fair enough.
He's a politician.
Fair enough. Anyway, I think it's going to be a mess. And that presumably is not going to be great for Republicans. And then the second dynamic that seems likely to emerge, okay, so you have a Republican House with a razor-thin majority, which makes Kevin McCarthy, the new Republican House presumptive leader's life miserable, right? That's very hard. On the other hand, that also could mean that they're being led by the nose by the more extreme Republican members in that, what's it called, that Freedom Caucus? Those people who are always threatening some crazy tunes thing, like, you know, not lifting the debt ceiling or whatever shenanigans they're going to pull.
Wait.
What?
Can I just, crazy tunes? Is that like the off-brand version of Looney Tunes?
Yeah, it is. Okay. I should have said Looney Tunes.
I don't care. I'm not. You may like the Marvel universe over the DC universe, but I like the Crazy Toons universe over the Looney Tunes universe.
I appreciate that. I didn't really even mean that, but thank you. So anyway, let's set aside the Senate for a moment since it remains a question mark. But you could imagine a world in which the Democrats, and particularly President Biden, are running against Republicans acting sort of their worst, which looks like a pretty good dynamic for Democrats. And then if Democrats hold the Senate, that's really the best possible outcome, because then Biden still is able to confirm judges. He's able to, you know, shuffle his cabinet around if he wants to do that. That's the question mark part. But that sounds like a pretty good. I mean, I'm sure a million things will go wrong, as they always do, or go differently than I'm suggesting. But it just seems like maybe at least a good place for Democrats to start as they look into the next 2 years.
I think as a political matter, what you're describing probably is a decent case for Democrats to have a crazy House that is acting self-destructively and a Senate that is able to at least approve judges and do various things to get Biden's appointees through. But for the country as a whole, it's pretty depressing. The chance of any kind of major legislation would be drops to nil. Minor legislation probably drops to nil. That if the GOP House is like emboldened to do something nihilistic, like not pay, you know, not allow us to pay our debts, or not pass a budget, then that's a really bad outcome for the country in the way people actually live, like not having national parks open, not having the full faith and credit of the United States trusted across the world anymore. Those are problematic things. So I think as a political matter, it might be good for Democrats for the Republican House to be crazy and not doing anything. As a citizen, I'm not too happy about it.
There's so many different categories of things to talk about in this case. I mean, right, we don't know what the situation is. I think just to your point, Emily, about the Freedom Caucus and the Crazy Tunes, if it looks like the House goes to the Republicans and Kevin McCarthy has to run, I mean, has to be Speaker, I mean, his troublemaking caucus is so much worse than the squad for Nancy Pelosi. It's hard to even talk about them in the same context. And his leadership ability is not tested the way Nancy Pelosi's is. I mean, John Boehner, remember in Republican history, John Boehner called people in the Freedom Caucus, like Jim Jordan, political terrorists because they didn't care about any of the things you have to actually do to govern. Newt Gingrich, when he was forced out by his version of the Freedom Caucus, called them political cannibals. Those two speakers had what looked like larger margins than McCarthy has. When you have a larger margin, you can allow some of your more bouncy colleagues to go bounce around and it doesn't threaten your votes. But when you say you have to get everything with Republican votes, it's almost impossible to govern, which means then you need Democratic votes to do anything. And when you start needing Democratic votes to do things, you change the legislation you're trying to pass so majorly to get those Democratic votes that you then start losing more Republican votes. These are the dynamics that essentially, crumpled Ryan, Boehner, and to some smaller degree, Gingrich. So that's the kind of fun that Kevin McCarthy has to deal with. And also then it determines who's in charge of the Senate. If it is Republicans, Mitch McConnell's not a House Freedom Caucus kind of guy. So when it comes to those budget questions you're talking about, David, McConnell does care about not destroying the U.S. economy by messing with the debt limit. Remember when TARP didn't pass the House first under George W. Bush, the market dropped 900 points in a day. And then all of the Republicans who didn't vote for TARP changed their position and got it through. Now, that may not have been good policy, but it's what ultimately happened is there was a kind of the Republicans in the Senate kind of convince the House Republicans to do the right thing. And that's, you'd have that dynamic all the time. Adding to that is the fact that you have all the Trump allies blaming McConnell for not supporting various Trump candidates, but the McConnell wing of the Republican Party blaming Trump for putting candidates into races that are all terrible candidates and that are costing the Republicans the Senate. That dynamic will repeat itself 1,000 times over on every fight as the Trump-aligned folks in Congress assert themselves on every possible budget and legislative thing. So it's going to be messy, which will maybe distract Democrats from their own messiness, which is probably not great for Democrats.
Can we go back actually to the point, Emily, you were making at the beginning about DeSantis? And DeSantis clearly had the best night of anybody on Tuesday. He is the happiest man in America. But is it certainly a two-person race for the Republican nomination for president, John? Is it really just already it's got to be one of these two guys and there's not any other credible candidate? And is it pretty clear that Trump is so wounded that DeSantis is going to walk to it? Or do you feel like there are many, many acts to play?
It's probably in DeSantis's interest to have a lot of candidates at the beginning, because it would send the message that the Republican Party has moved on from Donald Trump. All of the things that Donald Trump did while he was in office to change the standards and norms of the way we think about politics, America, and the office weren't enough to break apart the lock he had on the party. But perhaps his, having picked a few bad candidates will break the lock on the party, which gives you some sense of the of the underlying truth of Donald Trump, which is that he did so well in the Republican Party because he was a winner and people would basically put everything else aside. The majority of Republicans would put everything else aside if winning was what he could deliver to them and an effective use of power. But once he looks like he's not effective, I mean, he's now essentially lost in 18, 20, and 22. So he might actually be in trouble, but it needs to be probably a multi-fight. Now, as I say that, obviously that's how he won the nomination in 16. The non-Donald Trump vote in the primaries was larger than the vote that went for Donald Trump, but because it was split across candidates. But I think that DeSantis doesn't necessarily want this to be one-on-one. And also for Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, you know, you got to move when it's your time.
One dynamic I'm interested in with the Republicans is how much primary voters and the primary field recognizes that they could make this a generational contest, right? They could realize that a potential weakness for Biden is his age. He's, I think, about to turn 80. And not pick Trump, who's the old guy in that mix, unless there's another old person I'm forgetting. Any one of the people you named is in the more like 50s category, right? Or somewhere around there. And that would let the Republicans kind of claim, if not youth, at least middle age.
It's an excellent point. But as I try to think this through, Donald Trump is the greatest and most effective chaos muppet in the Republican ranks. I'm just ringing in my ears as his interview with Bob Costa and Bob Woodward in 2016, where they were trying to say to him, you know, you have to put your party back together after these primaries. He's like, no, I'm going to win first. This is at the end of the primaries. He's like, no, I'm going to win first and they will all come fall in line behind me. And he was 1,000% right. And he's been right about that all the way through, basically testing every norm of American political life. And he's always been right about his party falling in behind him. Maybe he'll be wrong this time, but that's just in my mind how right he has read his party and their tolerance for him.
GabFest listeners, on GabFest Reads, we have been every month talking to an author we admire who has a new book that we're excited about, and having a little bit of a longer conversation with them. And I'm so happy to say that on November 19th, we have a new episode, which is Emily talking to Beverly Gage about her book, G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the Making of the American Century. This is a book we've all been excited about. Bev Gage is a friend of Emily's, but she's an amazing historian. And this is a book that, from what I've heard, from the advance notice that I've heard, is an amazing book. So listen on November 19th. It'll just be in your GabFest feed. Any tidbits you want to tease listeners with, Emily?
It is an amazing book. I mean, it's the sweeping master narrative of J. Edgar Hoover, who controlled the FBI for so many decades. And the Washington Post published an early review of the book this week that paid it, I think, the ultimate compliment by saying that the reviewer, Kai Bird, said that it had changed his mind about Hoover, made him think of Hoover as a more complicated figure. Still sinister, but in sort of different ways. And Bev and I talked about that a lot in our interview. So I hope you listen and enjoy and buy the book, please.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a genuinely enthralling case involving the Indian Child Welfare Act. Indian law and Indian treaty cases are fascinating because they have a very different kind of valence than other cases, because they're rooted in two foundational issues in the history of this country. First, the creation of the United States involved the expulsion and murder and expropriation of property of the native populations that occupied the land before European settlement. And that mistreatment carried forward in all kinds of ways, has carried forward in the history of the country, including very intentional efforts to destroy Indian identity through the forcible re-education and relocation of children. And then second, Indian tribes have a relationship with the United States government by treaty that is entirely different than the relationship that any other group has with the United States. They are nations within the nation. They are not like any other group. And so when cases come up about the relationship between Indian tribes and Indians and the United States government, it's always really interesting, and this is no exception. So Emily, set the stage for us on this Indian child welfare case.
The Indian Child Welfare Act, let's just back up a second, Congress passed this law because there was this terrible history of Native American children being taken away from their families and their tribes and put into boarding schools where they're often abused. There was a lot of neglect. It's just a really sordid chapter of American history. And so it's called, for short, the ICWA, this law. And what it does is say that when there's a child whose parents can't take care of them, first you go to the family, then you go to the tribe, and then you go to another tribe. And you're supposed to take those placements into account in a way that isn't quite the same as what we would normally do with another kid, where you just consider the best interests of the child. You're supposed to give more weight. And the idea is that tribal identity and the community has a kind of stake here and a value that is particular to Indian law and to Native American society and culture. And there, you know, like I said, there's this deep history supporting this law. The question in this case is whether Congress had the power to pass this law in the first place, which is really a very radical view of this area of law. And so what the challengers are arguing is that this is a race-based classification, and thus it's unconstitutional, that it violates the Equal Protection Clause, because you're treating Native American children differently on the basis of race. And of course, what the defenders of the law are saying is, wait a second, as David, as you discussed in your intro, these are tribes with sovereign identities. This is also, or primarily, a political identity that Congress is paying attention to. And so that's the kind of fundamental tension in the case. And, you know, then we can talk about how the different justices were grappling with this question in the context of this challenge.
And we should note that when a case involving a child who needs to be fostered or put up for adoption takes place on tribal land, a child who's living on tribal land, it's very clear that the tribe and tribal authority makes the decisions, or has the authority to make the decision about that. This involves children who are not living on tribal land. In fact, in a lot of cases, are not enrolled in the tribe. And that's where it gets really complicated.
Yes. Then those cases get litigated in state court. And the question is, what standard does the Indian Child Welfare Act impose on state court judges who would otherwise use a best interest standard? And one of the things that the challengers to the law argued was that these kids who are not enrolled in tribes, like, that they were sort of having this identity imposed on them by other adults, which is another whole question about, you know, how to think about kids and where they come from and who they are and how they develop their identities.
Well, it does seem to me that if a child is an enrolled member of a tribe, that there's a very strong case, given the sovereign nature of tribes, there's a very strong case that you, like, should be very respectful of the tribe's decision of that identity of the child. If a child is not an enrolled member of the tribe, their parents, let's say, have not made that choice, then isn't that in itself a kind of political decision that a child, that the family has made? The child has said, we don't want to be part of this polity. We don't want the child to be part of this polity. And therefore, treating the child who is as part of this polity and imposing this identity on them even though the parents specifically didn't make a choice to enroll the child in the tribe, seems odd to me.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess I think it's really important to imagine that some kids could grow up and want to reclaim that identity. I also, and also people have reasons, especially if they're not on tribal land, for not enrolling in a tribe. And so I don't think it's always like a conscious choice, oh, I don't want to do this. It can just be not knowing how to do it or the difficulty of pulling it off or just the circumstances that someone's in. What I care much more about is what do you do? You know, to me, what's fundamental with child placement cases is making sure the kid is going to be okay. And so I get very nervous in any context where you have a child who's placed in a family who's thriving and then gets taken from that family after, you know, a number of months or, you know, a couple of years. That I find that often to be pretty devastating because we know that kids attach, and that just seems to me like a moment where you would want the best interest standard to really have some purchase. But that part of the conversation is not necessarily front and center in these particular challenges. It's much more about these questions of, like what you were talking about, David, what about from the get-go? So it's less about whether you might harm a child by taking them away from a non-native family where they were placed, as making sure that that doesn't happen in the first place and wondering whether tribes even have the ability to do that.
Is really the fight over whether they should be placed with other Indian families? Because it does seem to me also really weird to think you're an enrolled member of Tribe A, and the way that we're going to protect your Indian identity is to have you live with a family in Tribe B. It's not clear why those things. I mean, these are distinct sovereign nations. They are distinct nations, and therefore you should protect that national identity. But how do you protect that national identity by enrolling them in, or by having them placed with a family that's of an entirely different identity? And that treats Indianness as a single kind of, as a single thing rather than as these disparate things.
Yeah, I mean, that was the point of a couple of the conservative justices. Justice Barrett, to your exact point, said it's treating Indian identity as fungible. And I think that part of the law seems the most vulnerable. You can imagine, though, a situation in which there's a way in which tribes have a close relationship or some sense that at least there'll be a valuing of the idea of being a native kid. I don't mean to make it sound like they're interchangeable, but it doesn't seem irrational to me. And remember, if this is a political identity, then all that Congress needs is a rational basis for this law. If the court thinks this is a racial identity, then, you know, there's a higher standard. And so we'll just have to see what's going to happen on the court.
Given the incredibly terrible history of how tribes have been treated and how Indian children have been treated, you want to be very respectful of the views of tribes about how, what are, when tribes say we want to preserve this identity, here are the steps that we think are the best steps in the, given the circumstances, to preserve identity. It feels like there's an obligation, given the terrible way the government has handled this before, there's an obligation to be respectful of what the tribes say they think is the best interest of the child in these cases, because certainly the U.S. government did not act in the best interest of the child over centuries before that.
Right. And I guess one thing I was thinking about absorbing the arguments yesterday is, so imagine you have a newborn baby or, you know, a very young infant, and the family is not on tribal land, and maybe they're not enrolled, but the state authorities deciding where to place this infant know that they have this tribal connection and that ICWA governs. So in that moment, given the history that we've been talking about, wouldn't you want the American government first to look to the tribes for a placement for this kid? Like, why would you want that child to go to a non-native family without any consideration of this history and tradition they come from when we're talking about this, you know, incredibly embattled minority in the United States that's been treated with so much injustice and uncaring? That just seems like, right, you'd want to start with that. And if it doesn't, if you can't find someone, if it doesn't work out, that's like a different problem. But that you'd want to have a very robust system for foster care and adoption within tribes, and that you'd want to really respect that and nurture that, as opposed to just you know, treating this child like any other child. And, you know, I should also say, in the foster care and adoption context in the U.S., there's been more and more of a push for kinship ties when kids are placed, and a sense that, you know, when you take Black kids out of the Black community, that's not really very good for them or a good thing for the Black community. And I mean, to me, a lot of those things just kind of make sense, at least as like first principles of what to do with babies.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you, John Dickerson, are recovering from this mammoth week that you've had, and you're definitely kicking back with a drink, what are you chattering to the little Dickersons about?
Oh my God, I forgot to come up with a chatter.
That is really profound.
I could go first.
No, yeah, let's leave that in. Let's leave that in, yeah. John. You've been busy.
It's a perfect encapsulation of this week's like totally destabilizing thing.
We'll just take half of your minutes from your chatter last week and just give
Exactly. I liked what you were saying, Emily, when you were talking about absorbing the decision or the arguments. Like, you need to absorb last week's chatter, so I don't want to get in the way.
Emily, I hope you're not so overwhelmed. What's your chatter?
I'm not, but I have a chatter about the election, which I want to talk about these ballot measures in which voters directly confronted questions about whether they want to hang on to abortion rights or not in their state. And all of the ballot measures went in the direction of preserving rights to abortion. So we have votes in Kentucky and Vermont and California and Michigan and Montana. And it's just interesting to see that even in red and purple states, when you ask people this question straight up, they don't want to lose the right to an abortion. And we saw this obviously in the Kansas election over the summer. I was reading some of the abortion opponent response to the midterm results more generally, and there was a lot of blaming of messaging, like if you just change the messaging. And I don't think so. I mean, a solid majority of Americans think there should usually at least be a right to an abortion. They, you know, would probably like there to be some limits, but they don't want it simply taken away. And I think that's just an important political truth that we kind of lost sight of. And it suggests to me that some of the really aggressive tactics to try to prevent women from crossing state lines or try to prevent abortion pills from getting into the states, maybe that is going to have a real political price if Republicans pursue them. And so I'm very interested in how this election affects that dynamic over the next chapter of the political battle over abortion in the country.
Right. I mean, it was interesting that DeSantis had this tremendous victory. And one of the reasons he had this tremendous victory, people are saying, is maybe that he just didn't push on abortion. Florida passed a 15-week ban, but he hasn't pushed for more than that. And that might have been strategically wise. My chatter is just an experience that I'm having right now, which is that I am on a Twitter fast, not because of Elon Musk. I'm not on strike because of Elon Musk. I don't have an opinion about Elon Musk's ownership of Twitter, really, but because I was just feeling bad about Twitter, and it was made me feel stressed and unhappy. And I'm a happy person, and I must say that I'm a week into not being on Twitter. I do look at my DMs, and I will tweet a GabFest episode, but I'm not reading Twitter at all, and it's kind of great. I'm not sure exactly what I have more time for, but I definitely have more time for something. Listeners, you also have chatters. You've tweeted them to us. I don't know that because I don't check Twitter, so I didn't see them. But someone else is checking that at Slate GabFest Twitter account. But you also email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. And our listener chatter this week comes from Scott Grant.
Hello, Political GabFest. This is Scott Grant from Baltimore, Maryland. This chatter is about the Dunites, wine with a side of tangentially related presidential history. My partner and I were traveling in California's Central Coast, and we were hiking around the Guadalupe Nipomo Dune Park, where Cecil B. DeMille had filmed the Ten Commandments. We worked up a thirst. Off to wine tasting in San Luis Obispo, we stopped at a tasting room called Dunites. The man running our tasting told us that the winery was named after a group of wild artists who lived in the dunes in the early part of the last century. Turns out, around 1918 or so, some people started living in the dunes. Mystics, nudists, artists, writers, and hermits, if Wikipedia is to be believed. Sometime in 1930s, Chester A. Arthur's grandson, Gavin Arthur, who was a sexologist, moved in and started a magazine and commune called Moy Mel. I totally recommend visiting the park and tasting room.
That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. We're on tour, incidentally. Go check them out. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. Follow us on Twitter at SlateGadFest and tweet chatter to us there. And also, please send us your conundrums so that we can have great conundrums to slate.com/conundrums. You can just go to that website, slate.com/conundrums. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? We talked a lot about the election. We talked about the big topics in the election, but we also wanted to hit just particular aspects of the election that enticed us, entrapped us, delighted us, surprised us, maybe at a more local level or something that just a race that just didn't quite catch the attention that would put it on the front page of Emily's New York Times. So anyone want to start?
Because it's partially what I make my living off of, but we do it a lot here, interested always in how much any of this stuff really matters. what do I mean by that? Some of the late breaking questions in the Georgia race and the Pennsylvania race have been around, you know, what we might call October surprises. So in Pennsylvania, it was Fetterman's performance in the debate. In Georgia, it was the second abortion that Herschel Walker was accused of having paid for. Or maybe it was the combination of the first and the second. In the exit polls, with the normal caveats that we have to make about exit polls, but so in the exit polls in Georgia, when you asked voters, when did you finally make your decision? They ask, was it in October, before October, or in the last few weeks? So in the Walker-Warnock race, those who made their decision before October picked Warnock, but by a very small, it's 50-49. So basically split. But then in October, it's 50-45 Warnock-Walker, which would suggest that something changed in the race, that late deciders are going to Warnock over Walker. There is some scholarship and folk wisdom that says actually it's the challenger who sometimes gets the late breaking votes. So this would contradict that, so that would be explained by a late breaking piece of news. In Pennsylvania, same question. Who wins the October vote? Oz, by 58-40. Fetterman had before that been winning 55-45 among those voters. But in October, suddenly Oz is an 18 points ahead with the 17% of the electorate that said they decided in October. Which is interesting because when you look at the national exit polls, those who decided in October, the 19% who said they do, picked the Democrats 55-42. So a 13-point margin for the in-party for those deciders in October. So why did that happen nationally in October? Could it be the Paul Pelosi attack that was at the end of October? What was happening in the nation that changed? Because all other time periods in the national exit polls, the Republican candidate gets picked over the Democratic candidate. So anybody who decided before October or after October, but in October, the 20% roughly who picked, said they made their decision, made it for Democrats over Republicans. So this raises a lot of questions. A, should you even read exit polls this closely? Should you trust people's time stamping of when they made their decisions? All super valid questions. But it also suggests, at least at some level, that these things that happened in campaigns in Warnock, Walker, and in Otterman Fezerman, that these late-breaking developments did have an effect on the race, so that all of our mind-bending analysis of those races was warranted because it actually real things might have been happening.
I'll go next. I live in Washington, D.C., and there was an interesting initiative on the ballot, 82, a voter initiative, to get rid of the tipped minimum wage. So in D.C., as in I think basically everywhere in the U.S., there's a tipped minimum wage. So if you are a tipped worker, you can be paid a wage that is much lower than the basic minimum wage. In D.C., the tipped minimum wage is about $5, and I think the basic minimum wage, I think it's more like $15. And the idea is that you will make up, even though you're only earning $5 an hour in your wage, you'll make it up in tips, and that's fine. And so there was a voter initiative on the ballot here in D.C. to get rid of that and to say that there's no such thing as a tip minimum wage. If you were a worker, you get a minimum wage of $15. And this actually, we had this as a voter initiative a few years ago, which passed, but then it was subverted by the D.C. Council. This was basically the same initiative brought back, and it passed overwhelmingly. D.C. voters voted overwhelmingly to get rid of the tip minimum wage. And I voted for it. I voted for it actually after I listened to a CityCast D.C. That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.